Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and this is episode 121 with Dr. Larissa DeSantis of Vanderbilt University on the dietary ecology of Smilodon fatalis. This episode was another listener request, so thanks to Britt for that, and if you have an interview you want to hear yourself in the future, please feel free to get in touch via email or on social media. Speaking of which, we're only 30 likes away from 5,000 on Facebook and 10 subs away from 3,000 on YouTube. So help us reach those milestones and you can all have 10 symbolic PaleoCast points or something, I don't know. Now, this episode is a two-parter, and deviating from our usual standard, we'll no longer be using the episode 121A and 121B, but instead we'll be using 121 and 122. Now, the reason for this isn't that we want to have more episodes, but that our audio host won't accept anything other than a whole numerical number, which really is a pain to have to change all of that in our eighth year now. Either way, they'll be released in sequence and both will be displayed on the same page of our website, which is also where you'll find all of the images to accompany this episode, so please do check that out. And finally, if you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review and share our posts on social media to help the show reach the biggest audience possible. Hi, Larissa. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we like to get to know our interviewees first, and our usual question that we start off with is just understanding how you got into paleontology in the first place.
Sure. Yeah, that's a really interesting one, because if you had asked me if I wanted to be a paleontologist any time when I was growing up, I probably wouldn't have said yes, although I did always have a fascination with fossils. And I grew up going to the La Brea Tar Pits and also going and taking summer courses at the Natural History Museum in Los Angeles. So I was always fascinated by science, but I actually thought I was going to be a congresswoman. I was sort of on the debate team, a political science major, super excited to sort of enter the world of politics, which I am very happy I did not do, randomly happened upon a course in paleobiology. So it was actually just, you know, one of these weird circumstances where I was taking a sequence of biology classes at the University of Chicago. And, you know, I took ecology and evolution, loved it. I took physiology, loved it. And then immunology, the professor wasn't particularly wonderful. There was no textbook for the class. I couldn't understand the first lecture. And on my way out of the course, a friend came up to me and said, "Hey, there's this paleobiology class. Do you want to check it out with me?" And I said, "Sure." And so, you know, I actually don't know that the instructor knows this, but you're supposed to be a junior bio major, but you needed this blue slip of paper to take the course. And after listening to one lecture, I was completely fascinated. It had all the sort of theory I liked with political theory, but it was evolutionary theory. And then within a week of just taking that course, I volunteered to prepare dinosaur bones at the University of Chicago. And so I started working in the basement, preparing, you know, Super Croc and Suchomimus and Jobaria and these different really amazing, iconic fossils. And that just, it got me the bug. And actually from there, I transferred to the University of California, Berkeley. I was from California originally. It was much cheaper than University of Chicago and a little warmer too. And when I transferred, I, you know, knew I wanted to sort of get involved with paleo again. And I immediately started working in the prep lab. I got to meet all of the graduate students and they sort of connected me with, you know, the different classes I should take. But at the same time, I was actually managing my major was resource management. And so, you know, with resource management, I felt like, you know, at that time, so I'm going to bring you back into the late 90s, at that time, you know, there really wasn't this field that has now emerged, which is conservation paleobiology. There was conservation and there was paleobiology, but there was not sort of the integration of the two, or really wasn't, you know, that well established. And so I felt like I was having to choose between, you know, my desire to help the planet and to study conservation, and my selfish kind of passion for the ancient past. And so I actually tried really hard not to go into paleontology. I loved it, but I graduated and said, you know, how many jobs are there in paleontology? I'm going to do environmental management. So I went off to Yale to do a master's in environmental management. And it was the first time I was away from paleo, and I really missed it. And so I sort of said, you know, is there a way that I can begin to integrate these things? And I really had to do some soul searching. I also really loved education. And so I did a lot of work with the Peabody Museum. And eventually, after I graduated, I drove a 38-foot Winnebago around New York City that was filled with dinosaur exhibits for the American Museum of Natural History. And so that was, you know, super fun. We brought, you know, dinosaurs essentially to kids throughout all of New York City with a range of, you know, abilities and disabilities. And it was just, you know, it was super fun and fascinating, but I missed the research. And so through this sort of exploration, I finally said, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to bite the bullet. I'm going to, you know, do the PhD. I want to be a paleontologist. And fortunately for me, I was able to work with Dr. Bruce McFadden at the University of Florida. And there I was able to foster all of my interests in conservation, my interests in paleontology, and also my interests in education. And so I was able to kind of work on all of those and also bring them together. And now my research program very much asks questions that are of relevance to conservation, but use the fossil record to answer those questions. So it's a bit of a long story, but that's sort of my story.
It's fantastic. You sound like you've been all over the place, seen every side of paleontology, flirted with different subjects like politics that, just not as good as dead animals, I'm afraid.
Well, part of that too was when I was a young child, I had epilepsy, and I was the national poster child for the Epilepsy Foundation. So I had the great fortune of being able to meet, you know, a congressman who had epilepsy. I was able to meet George H.W. Bush and advocate for the Americans with Disabilities Act. And so through that process, you know, it made me want to go into politics. It made me want to be sort of to help people. And in some way, I feel like even though I've gone into paleontology, I very much, you know, focus a lot of my research on trying to make it relevant to conservation, trying to make it relevant to our understanding of evolutionary history so that, you know, we can benefit as well.
Okay, so today we're going to be talking about diets of extinct mammals. How do the diets feed into that?
So unlike sort of our human diets, where we can be pretty selective about what we eat, with most animals, diet is really key to everything they do. It's key to where they live, how they move, sort of how they move across the landscape, i.e. migration, and even influences reproduction. And so, you know, a classic example you can think of is if you're a koala and you eat eucalyptus, you have to live where there's eucalyptus forests. If you are a grazer, you need to live where there are grasslands. And so this can really, you know, elucidate a lot about an animal by just understanding their diet.
Wow. And that's their dietary ecology.
Yeah. So dietary ecology is kind of has two parts in it. It has diet and ecology. And ecology is more than biology, right? So biology is what an animal kind of does in its physiology, but also its ecology involves how it interacts with its abiotic environment, right? So what kind of habitat does it live in? How is it influencing its environment? How is its environment influencing it? And then dietary ecology is kind of all of that together. So how does the diet of an animal influence sort of its movement across the landscape, how it interacts, how it hunts, all of those things sort of all rolled up into one.
So thinking back to when I was in school learning about biology, pretty much for some of the first time, one of the things that we would discuss are different animals and a way to tell whether they were a herbivore or whether they were a predator was to look at their teeth, for example. You'd have flat teeth for herbivores, sharp teeth for predators. And that was the lesson there. But are there any more proxies to dietary ecology that we can see in the anatomy of an animal.
Yes, absolutely. So what you're talking about is essentially the morphology or the gross morphology. So the size and shape of the teeth of those animals. And so, yes, you know, flat teeth, herbivore, sharp teeth, predator, those definitely hold true. We can also do things like finite element analysis, where you can actually use sort of an engineering tool to sort of look at bite forces. And so I'll talk a little bit more about Smilodon and their bite force a little bit later. But morphology tells us potential diet. It tells us what an animal might be able to eat based on its evolutionary history. And while this does reveal quite a bit of information, we know that animals can do different things while they're alive than potentially what they're just suited to do morphologically. And so what I mean by this is, you know, we can see that, you know, an animal that eats browse or leaves might also eat some grass in its lifetime, or vice versa. A grazer might also eat some browse. So to actually get at sort of what these animals are actually eating, we can use other proxies like stable isotopes and dental microware. And so stable isotopes, essentially, you are what you eat. And so everything you eat is incorporated into your tissues, be it your skin, your bones, your kidneys, your liver, your breath, essentially everything. And so what we can actually do is take advantage of that and sample the teeth. And the reason why we sample teeth is they're sort of the gold standard. So unlike your kidneys, for example, or other organic tissues that are going to degrade, enamel essentially locks in that dietary signal at the time when it's mineralizing. And it, you know, just like a rock, you know, enamel is really resilient to being altered after deposition. And so it's really useful for getting at sort of the diets of these animals. So we will actually drill the teeth. We do a little bit of paleo dentistry. And we then take that, you know, little bit of enamel powder. We clean it with various chemicals to get out, you know, any sort of contamination. And then we run it on a mass spec. And what that then does is it will tell us, you know, whether an animal was eating, you know, C3 plants or C4 plants, or in the case of carnivores, whether they were eating prey that themselves were eating those C3 plants or C4 plants. And typically those C3 plants are things like leaves and shrubs. And typically C4 plants are things like, you know, warm season grasses, but it's not always the case. And so sometimes it's really useful to use other tools, especially when we're studying herbivores, so that we can kind of get at the dietary ecology of the animals, especially when there are C3 grasses and C3 shrubs, C4 grasses and C4 shrubs in an ecosystem, which is the case many places, including places like Australia. And so we can use tools like microware.
Okay. And is it better to take a holistic approach and just include absolutely everything? Or can one of those things by itself tell you pretty much everything that you need to know?
So it depends on the system you're studying and the question that you're trying to ask. So when I was looking at herbivores in Florida and how they responded to changing climates, in Florida, at the time period I was looking at, the Pleistocene, C3 indicated that these animals were eating shrubs, trees, et cetera, browse. And C4 was a really good indicator of grass, right? C3 grasses were rare in this system. C4 shrubs were also rare in this system. And I was focusing on mammalian herbivores. So using isotopes alone could give me a pretty good indication of the diets of these animals through time. Now, at higher latitudes or further back in time, it's really useful to look at, you know, microware in addition to isotopes when you're talking about herbivores. Now, in the case of carnivores, you get very different pieces of information from the microware versus the isotopes. So the isotopes can tell you the type of habitats that the prey that they consumed resided in. So, for example, were they eating forest-dwelling prey or open grassland-dwelling prey? Isotopes can tell you that. Or in the case of microware, it tells us the degree of carcass utilization. So were they avoiding bone like cheetahs, or were they actively consuming bone like hyenas. And so microware reveals that piece of information, which is quite different than the habitat of the prey that the animal was eating.
And could it ever be possible to be precise with that? So for instance, I'm just coming up with a scenario off the top of my head. We have a predator living in a certain environment. We're looking at the isotopes, and that's saying that it's prey fed primarily on this, but couldn't prey, for instance, migrate? Or could we also look at the dental microware and say, okay, it's not very worn in its canines, so it's probably eating just a lot of flesh as opposed to bone, but then the teeth aren't necessarily all the same. They have different functions. It could just be chewing bone on its back teeth. So do these all have to be taken into consideration as well?
Yes. So before we can use these tools, we actually make sure that they work on modern animals. So before we even ventured into the Pleistocene, we ventured to extant African carnivore sort of communities, right? We looked at cheetahs, lions, and hyenas, and we looked at their microware. So in the case of feliforms, which include those groups, so cheetahs, lions, and hyenas, so felids plus their relatives, so feliforms, including hyenas, when you look at that group as a whole, they essentially have one large tooth that they're usually processing bone with, and it's their carnassial. It's the same tooth that they are shearing meat with. So they use it for multiple functions. Now, in the case of dogs, they actually have teeth behind that carnassial tooth that they will process bone with. And so understanding which tooth to look at in the case of dogs or in the case of looking at bears, for example, it's really important that you actually study modern animals today where you know what their diets are, you know, and can observe their dietary behavior, looking at those specimens from museum collections and making sure the method works first before you apply it to the fossil record. So that's essentially what we had to do. In the case of cats, it's actually fairly easy because we have that carnassial tooth that we can look at that sort of represents all of these different functions. And we see quite a big difference between cheetahs, for example, that actively avoid bone. We know this, we can observe it today. And they have sort of lots of shearing exhibited on their teeth and very little crushing. Whereas hyenas actively consume bone. Again, we observe that, we see them doing it today, and we see lots of deep pits in the hyena teeth. And so that can essentially help us calibrate how we can use these tools. But yes, we don't want to compare a canine to a carnassial tooth. You know, if you're looking at incisors, which some people do in hominids to understand how they're using their incisors, that's going to be very different than their molars. You know, within paleoanthropology, they look at, you know, one particular facet on molar teeth in many cases. And so it's, you have to be very careful how to interpret these data and make sure you understand by using modern specimens, sort of how, you know, living animals today are recording their environment.
Okay. And with my most immediate example I can come up with, I have two cats talking about feliforms, Izzy and Gatsby, and they eat, they're the same species, but they eat different things. Gatsby prefers his harder kibble. Izzy prefers meat and just fresh food. But then also they change their diets over time. They get fed up of one different type of food. Gatsby loves getting plastic and chewing on that. Can you incorporate that variability when you are defining the dietary ecology of a species? And then also thinking about the individuals, there is also ontogeny, so how these animals are growing, the different diets that they might have as they get older. And then also seasonal variability as well. So say like the availability of a food source of, for example, as I've used before, a migrating set of animals that would come into a predator's environment. So can you take into account those individual differences, or do you only ever really look at the entire species?
Yeah, so that's a fantastic question. We can actually do both, but it depends on the tools that we're using. So in the case of isotopes, we can actually get a lot of information about the individual from the isotopes. So in particular, what we can do is take what are called serial samples. So there are a series of samples that sort of march along the growth axis of the tooth. And what essentially we're able to do is understand what that animal was doing at the time that little shred of enamel was mineralizing, and then the next bit of enamel, and then the next bit of enamel. And so we take a series of samples up the tooth, and depending on how long it takes that tooth to mineralize, in some animals like horses or Smilodon with these elongated canines, it might take, you know, several years for those teeth to mineralize. And so as their diet is changing potentially throughout the seasons, throughout the year, you can actually track that. And so it's one really great way, and a way that we often use to look at sort of seasonal variability. You know, was the climate, you know, really variable at that time? Were they changing their diet? And so using, you know, horses, bison, for example, we can really track those changes in diet or changes in climate over time, which is fantastic. And the same can be done with Smilodon canines. But I will say, and this is actually sort of talking about a paper that we have in submission at the moment, so I don't want to say quite so much, but I will give a little bit of an inkling as to what we're finding out. And that is that individuals, like you said about your cats, Izzy and Gatsby, can be quite specialized individually. And so that's something we do really need to take into consideration. And what we're actually beginning to learn is that even things that we consider sort of generalists, so there's a particular horse called Como Hyperion Emsleyi. We think of it as a kind of eating just about everything. When we look at the isotopes at any one, you know, sample, it can be a value of 0, which indicates it's eating in a grassland, to a value of negative 13, which means it's eating, you know, forest browse, leaves on off of trees, for example. But if we go in and zoom in on any single individual of Como Hyperion, we actually find that they're individually very specialized. So as a population, they're highly generalized, but individually, they're very specialized. And so we've done some more work on this. And so that's something that is sort of really exciting. And I look forward to having come out hopefully in the next few months. It's with a whole team of people, so I don't want to say too much about that. But absolutely, we can, you know, we need to look at sort of the individual diets, and then collectively we can kind of piece that all together and get a better understanding of what the species is doing.
That's really
now,
cool.
Now, I will say, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And one other thing I just want to mention is microwear. So the good and the bad of microwear, it's sort of a double-edged sword. The good of it, the wonderful benefits of microwear, is that we can really get at the diet right before the animal died. So when that animal is, you know, exactly the size that it is at that moment right before it died, we get that dietary information. But because microwear is constantly rewritten, you know, we can't look at it and earlier interval of time. And so it is very much a snapshot. And so that's why it's really important to look at these different proxies, because one sort of gives us a snapshot of diet, the other gives us potentially more of a longer term diet. And then if we do serial sampling, we can actually get at variability within a given year potentially.
Yeah, that's cool. That's so cool that you can do all that. I didn't know too much about dietary ecology and stuff before this interview, so it's all news to me, and it's awesome what you can tell.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I will say we named our lab the Dream Lab, which stands for Dietary Reconstructions and Ecological Assessments of Mammals. So we also think it's pretty cool.
So today we're going to be looking at the dietary ecology of the saber-toothed cat Smilodon. But first, I'd just like to set the scene for the discussion. So for those who aren't aware, can you tell us about Rancho La Brea?
Rancho La Brea is one of the, if not the most spectacular late Pleistocene site in the world. It is located smack dab in the middle of Los Angeles. There are sky rises, you know, just within sight of the La Brea tar pits. But it's an amazing site that essentially has preserved a large number of carnivorous fossils, but also lots of herbivorous ones as well. A few things about it. So it has recorded at least the last 50,000 years of fossils that have been deposited at this location. And essentially how fossils are deposited are, you know, a mammoth or a camel or a horse or bison basically steps in this tar, or rather asphaltum, and they get stuck. And so whether it's their, you know, decaying body or some noises that they're making or whatever it is, there then it draws the attention of many predators to that site. And so the predators also get stuck in the tar. And essentially, because of that, we actually get more carnivores found at Rancho La Brea than we do herbivores. But we also get the herbivores, which is fantastic. And what's important about getting a large number of carnivores is typically carnivores are rare. So think of the trophic pyramid. How often do you see grass or a tree? Daily. How often do you see a squirrel or deer? Right. So maybe less frequently as you see the grass or the trees. How often do you see a coyote or a wolf or some other carnivore in the landscape? And so essentially, you know, we already know that there's this trophic pyramid, that there are fewer carnivores than there are herbivores, and there are primary productivity in plants, et cetera, on the landscape. But that also makes it very difficult to study carnivores, because carnivores are typically, you know, so rare in fossil localities. They accumulate sort of in proportion to their abundance on the landscape. But at Rancho La Brea, they accumulate in higher numbers because of the preservational trap, because the herbivores are stuck, because the carnivores are lured to those decaying or fresh free meals of herbivores. They then get stuck, and we have this amazing opportunity to study carnivores in ways that we can't do anywhere else in the world, in the numbers, in the amount of specimens that we can actually analyze that are just impossible anywhere else in the world.
And that's what it means to be a predator trap, is that right?
Yes, exactly.
And what is the preservation like here? Because all of this asphalt isn't very good at preserving the soft body of these mammals. So you often get the bones. And so I think it's termed a concentrate Lagerstätte, so that is that you've got a concentration of fossils over a conservat one, which is a conservation Lagerstätte, where you get a remarkable preservation of the few remains that you get.
Exactly. So we get lots of bones, but they're all disarticulated and mixed together. And that does cause some problems. One of the major problems is at most fossil localities, your oldest specimens are on the bottom, and then younger specimens are on top, much like your sort of laundry pile at home. Your laundry from earlier in the week is always at the bottom, and then the sort of laundry from the other day might be at the top of the hamper. But when you have a locality like this, where these fossils are constantly getting mixed and they're disarticulated, it can be very difficult to know the exact age of these specimens. Fortunately, we are within the time window where we can do radiocarbon dating. So we can actually radiocarbon date the bones precisely and get an idea of how old the individual specimens are. And actually, at this moment, I am part of a 6-institution effort that's funded by the National Science Foundation. It includes lots of folks from Loyola Marymount, from the La Brea Tar Pits and from other institutions, and we're actually radiocarbon dating about 400 specimens because we want to precisely know exactly when in time an animal lived, and then extracting out all the other information. So we can get the isotopes from the bone, which can tell us something different about diet. So bone isotopes, bone collagen, can tell us more about the protein components. Enamel can tell us whole diet. We then can get the microware, which can tell us something about either degree of carcass utilization in carnivores or browse versus leaf consumption in herbivores. We can then look at the morphology of that specimen, and then we can date it. And then with that date, we not only know when in time it occurred, but because there are climate proxies from other places, cores, lakes, and even global sort of ice core data, we can then match that up with those records and begin to tease apart how these animals have responded to climate change, to humans coming over, how their ecology has, you know, changed over time. And so that's an effort, but it does take a lot of effort to radiocarbon date all of the specimens, and also quite a bit of funding to do that as well.
So now that we've got our Smilodon remains, our Smilodon bones, maybe its skull, maybe some teeth, what kinds of data can we actually get from it?
So there's a lot that we can learn. We can study the morphology. We can estimate its bite force by doing sort of a CAT scan and then a finite element analysis. We can measure it and see potentially how big it was. We can also drill its teeth, and that's where we get that isotopic data. What types of prey was it eating? And we can also take non-destructive molds, much like you do at the dental office when you have a crown or braces, put this sort of blue goo on the teeth. We clean the teeth really good. We pull off the blue goo, and then we can make a cast and look at the microscopic wear pattern. So there's quite a bit of information. We can also get at sort of information about these animals from the sheer numbers of Smilodon. So there's a lot that we can learn about, you know, whether they were social or not social based on, you know, how many were preserved relative to other specimens. So just not only can an individual specimen give us information, but sort of the specimens, you know, collectively, the variety that we get can also give us lots of information.
Does the nature of preservation at Rancho La Brea make that harder to determine? So all your specimens are broken up, they're all jumbled about, and then also they've been boiling in oil for thousands of years, and I'm guessing that might mess up some of the chemical analysis.
So it can, if that asphaltum impregnates into the bone. And what we're trying to get at is bone collagen in some cases. And so we have great colleagues like John Salton from UC Irvine, who has worked in incredible detail and to really kind of be able to remove the contaminants when looking at bone collagen. So there's a lot of things that we can do to really make sure we clean the teeth very well. Also, they haven't really been boiling at a high temperature within that asphaltum. They are moving around. There is gas that's coming up, which makes these big sort of large bubbles that we often see. But the temperature isn't necessarily very high. That being said, we as excavators back in the day would take a lot of these bones and then boil them in kerosene to clean them. And so that could potentially lead to contamination or, you know, challenge our ability to get things like DNA from them, for example.
Sure. Okay. I'd probably just been led by popular media, assuming that they were just bubbling in oil. Boiling in oil.
Oh, there are these massive bubbles that come up. I mean, if you could stare and look at the tar pits, and it's really amazing. So there's, you know, a lot of gas coming out, but it's not hot in temperature. In fact, it's really neat if you just go to Hancock Park and you walk around where the La Brea tar pits are, there's still, you know, asphaltum seeping up, you know, on the grass. So there's, you know, soccer practice going on, or football practice, I guess you would say, in the UK. And they have, you know, little cones set up where the asphaltum is coming up so you don't step in it. So it's still very much, you know, collecting things and active as it ever was.
So now that we've collected our data, can you actually tell what Smilodon was eating? Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall-Smith. Paleocast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the Paleocast Gaming Network. Okay, and what kinds of detail can you find at Rancho La Brea? Because it's not a concentrat Lagerstätte. No, it is a concentrat Lagerstätte. It's not a conservat Lagerstätte. So the conservat is concentration. That's a German word for concentration. And concentrat is concentration. Oh, God, I just confused myself so much. It all just sounds so familiar. Similar. Right. Anyway, let's do that again.
Sure.